Hello, and thanks for turning on The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. This is edition number 33. I'm Bruce Jacobs, a producer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. In this episode, the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan talks about the best ways to fight groups like Al-Qaeda.
Every time you can increase the influence of democracy, you decrease the influence of extremism.
And in Pakistan's Swat Valley, a look at the lasting impact the Taliban's brief rule had on the area's music culture and the lives of women. But we begin with the drama of the Libyan Revolution. Rebel forces overran Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's compound in Tripoli this week. After the euphoria calms down, there's still a country to govern. I'm joined now by correspondents Abdelilah Noaimi and Nabil Ahmed, who've been covering the story for RFERL's Radio Free Iraq. Let me start with you, Nabil. Will Libya's National Transition Council be up to the job of taking over ministries, setting up elections, even providing basic services in the coming weeks and months?
Of course, we have to know that the council has no prior experience with such very important tasks. But from what we have been hearing from Mustafa Abdeljalil, the chairman, as well as his other colleagues, they seem to be up to the job. Considering the fact that most of them have actually been in government posts under Gaddafi. Don't forget, Abdeljalil was the Minister of Justice. Plus, there were other people with him, like the former Chief of Staff, who was unfortunately assassinated, Abdel Fattah Yunus. So I guess they will be up to the job with assistance by, still they need the assistance of probably NATO, UK, France, and these countries have already stated their willingness to help.
Gaddafi was known for weakening a lot of the institutions of the country, whether they're political, social, or even security. Could you maybe walk through specifically what is needed to be done to get the country up and moving again? What are the steps that the NTC have to take?
Well, first of all, you need, I think, a viable police force to maintain law and order. Secondly, you need, in the immediate period, humanitarian assistance, as well as, just like President Obama said, aid for the wounded, and there are thousands of them. Plus, start with reassuring the populace that the next period will be inclusive. There will be national reconciliation. They will not dissolve the army or whatever remains of it, just like what happened in Iraq. As we know, this turned out to be a mistake. So these are some of the major tasks in the period ahead.
Well, Abdelilah, one thing that many have noted in the story is that one thing that united all the rebel factions was getting Gaddafi out of power. That now appears to have been achieved. The question is what will unite the country? And the question is, the country's known for its tribal divisions. What are the challenges that poses to the country politically? Do you think the country can hold together, or will it divide according to tribal lines?
Well, as my colleague Nabil said, I think national reconciliation should be the cardinal task in the immediate period, and as well as avoiding any vendettas or retaliatory measures against supporters of the former regime. This will go a long way in reassuring the people that the new setup is serious in lifting the country out of the present situation.
But Nabil, I mean, what's your hard assessment? I mean, if you had to predict what's really going to happen, I mean, there was the assassination of the general. There was, that caused some, intertribal tension just by itself. But there's got to be a lot of other things boiling below the surface. What's the potential danger that those could erupt into something that could pull the country in the wrong direction?
I think there are many potential dangers. One of them, is probably infighting between the next elites. We know this has happened in many Arab countries before. And so there might be a tendency for one of the new leaders to, emulate, former leaders or military men who took over, because we still, in the Arab world, we still don't have a culture of democracy. This is one of the potential dangers. But as you know, things are not yet settled. And so there will be many dangers ahead. One of them, if they all agree, they have to, of course, to impose, as I said, law and order. They have to bring back those who defected from Gaddafi in the past few weeks. And they could help, for instance, Shukri Ghanem, the guy who was in charge of oil, diplomats, top diplomats, the former foreign minister Moussa Koussa, and other technocrats as well. They didn't join the opposition earlier on, but they could still lend their support to the new elite.
Well, let me just conclude by asking you both if you could rate on a scale from 1 to 10 the chances that in 10 years' time or 5 years' time, Libya will be an open, democratically run country. What would you say the chances of that are?
I would say that after more than 4 decades of suppression and dictatorship, people will in time appreciate the freedoms they enjoy and the democracy that provides for everyone to express their views. And they will appreciate the value of all these things and hold on to them. And that's why I'm optimistic.
So out of 1 to 10, what would you say? You'd give it a chance of a 10?
I would say 7 out of 10.
You know, as I said a while ago, we don't have a culture of democracy in the Arab world. And judging from the experience in Iraq after 8 years, we know what's going on in this country. So we do have democracy on the face of it, but actually infighting goes on. Tendencies of authoritarianism are still there. I think Libya will go through the same process. So I'm not very optimistic. It's going to be very hard, challenging. The Libyans do have the financial resources to build, to rebuild their country, to emerge as a modern country 10 years from now. But as I said, democracy is a gradual thing, and they have to learn it, you know, step by step. And hopefully they will probably get 7 out of 10 at the end of a 10-year period.
Well, let me ask Abdelilah, what do you see the potential for the threat of Al-Qaeda taking root in Libya?
Well, it's a real threat, I think, but not necessarily inevitable. I mean, if people get together and unite around a single aim, which is democracy, with all that it entails, including freedom of speech, respecting the other view. I think Al-Qaeda, if they have a presence, and I think they do, will be excluded, will be eliminated in the final by peaceful means.
And Nabil, based on what you know about Libyan society, what do you see on that issue?
Today I read a very interesting article by the former British Chief of Staff, General Lord Danat, in the Telegraph, and he mentioned a very nice idea, I think, about this specific subject. He said, as long as we don't send aid workers, I mean Western aid workers or troops or Western advisors, we don't give Al-Qaeda the pretext that we gave them in Iraq, that here you have another Western intrusion. And this is what actually helped promote Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Okay, Abdulillah Noaimi, Nabil Ahmed, correspondents with Radio Free Iraq, thank you very much for joining me.
Please, thank you.
Радіо Фардо по шома
говорить Радіо Свобода.
А за тим, де та є.
Mark Grossman, the U.S. senior representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, recently sat down at the State Department in Washington with Voice of America's Lena Rosby. They discussed a wide range of regional issues, from the future of Al-Qaeda to India-Pakistan relations and the recent instability in Afghanistan.
Mr. Michael Leider, the former head of NCTC, said in an interview that Al-Qaeda still remains a threat in Pakistan, but according to him, it is on the rope. Do you agree with his view?
Well, I think my analysis is, and of course he is entitled to certainly his opinion, my analysis is that the killing of Osama bin Laden in the Badabad gives us the opportunity to now finish Al-Qaeda. What's that going to take? It's going to take a huge amount of cooperation from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, from countries all around the world, because this is our opportunity now to really defeat this organization.
President Nassif Ali Zardari in Pakistan legalized the political parties' operations in tribal areas. Do you think by doing this they can eliminate the influence that militant might have over that part of Pakistan?
Well, obviously, the way Pakistan organizes its own government is its business. But as far as I'm concerned, I think the increased amount of democracy in Pakistan, more political parties, more integration of that part of Pakistan into the rest of that society has got to be a positive thing. And so we've supported the civilian government there, the efforts that they're making politically, economically, democratically, to move Pakistan forward. And so, as I say, you know, that decision is really for Pakistanis to make. But I think that every time you can increase the influence of democracy, you decrease the influence of extremism.
Secretary Clinton has designated Haqqani Network commander Zadran, Sangin Zadran, and this happened when the war and the tension in Paktika province in Afghanistan is intensifying and it's considered a safe haven for Haqqani Network in Afghanistan. Is U.S. in any way stepping up pressure on this particular network in the region?
Well, I think as Secretary of State Clinton and Secretary of Defense Panetta have said recently, the Haqqani Network remains for us a real matter of concern. And we've talked about it with Pakistanis. And when Secretary Clinton talks about the need for Pakistani cooperation to end the safe havens and enablers of people who go into Afghanistan to attack American forces, Afghan civilians, that the Haqqani Network is very much on our minds there. Mm-hmm. The designation is something that we do from time to time when it's possible to identify somebody from a group like that who's got connections to terrorism. I think it's well within our rights and really our responsibility to designate them, as Secretary Clinton did.
If we go back to Afghanistan, a wave of assassination and other type of attacks are being the oppositions are doing against the Afghan officials in that country. And this is happening when the Afghan security forces just started to take on the security responsibilities in certain parts of Afghanistan.
Right.
Do you think that this raise in violence against government officials in Afghanistan can in any way reverse or threaten the gains that are made in governance and security?
I don't think so. I hope that the response of the Afghan people will be to see that these assassinations show the insurgents for what they are. You know, these are people who use 8-year-old girls as suicide bombers. You know, people who send people to funerals with bombs in their turbans. I mean, at some point, I think the Afghan people will come and say, you know, they're showing their real face here. You know, and we're interested in Afghan-led reconciliation. We're interested in the transition. We're interested in all these things. But at some point, it seems to me enough is enough. Suicide bombing, attacks on schools, attacks on hospitals. Now, these are the kinds of things, really, I think that shouldn't take place in any country. Now, if you say to me, you know, will this kind of undermine the transition, I think it'll make people worry more about it, but the transition will go forward. We believe that the military surge has been successful, and one of the reasons that you see these assassinations is that the Taliban has chosen this tactic to try to strike back because they have been damaged militarily.
The presidential election in Afghanistan will take place in 2014, and Secretary Clinton mentioned yesterday that there should be an active political process to elect the successor of President Karzai in 2014. Mm-hmm. How should this process be, and when should it start in Afghanistan, in your view?
In my view, that's a question for the Afghan people. I thought the statement that President Karzai made the other day about he didn't think he would be right to be president after 2014, and I think if you look at that statement, what did he say? You know, it was democratic, it was part of the Constitution. And so we admire that. In terms of the campaign can start when Afghans want it to start. Now, what I would say is that it should be open and transparent and democratic. And then, you know, who Afghans choose to be the president is a matter for Afghans, not for Americans.
If we go back to also one of the other important issues that currently affecting the political arena in Afghanistan, it's the result of parliamentary election in 2010. There's a lot of political debates and political entanglement in regards to the result of this election. How would you like to see this issue resolved in Afghanistan?
We'd like to see it resolved in an Afghan way, by Afghans. And I thought that, again, the statement that was made the other day by the president, that the Independent Election Commission was in charge of this, that they would make these decisions, seemed to us a step forward. But, you know, the Afghan parliament is a matter for Afghans. And what we're interested in is democracy, institutions, transparency. Those are the principles. As I say, I thought that the statement that was made empowering the IEC here was a positive development.
That was Mark Grossman, the U.S. Senior Representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, interviewed by Voice of America's Lena Rosby. You're listening to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. Although Taliban extremists were driven out of Pakistan's Swat Valley in 2009, their prohibition on music, and especially women in the arts, has done lasting damage to Swat's musical culture. Correspondent Gregory Pfeiffer narrates this story, produced by Araf Yarel's Radio Mashal.
Nabila is studying music and dance in the town of Mingora in Pakistan's Swat Valley. This neighborhood is the main center for music in Pakistan's Pashtun-dominated regions. For decades, Swat was the only place in the conservative Pashtun belt where female singers and dancers were a vital part of cultural life. But that changed in 2007, when Taliban militants took over the Swat Valley. They banned all music and ordered women to stay out of public life. Extremists destroyed girls' schools and murdered a popular female dancer, a warning to anyone who dared violate the Taliban's code. A major Pakistani military operation drove out the Taliban leadership in 2009. Some 2.5 million people were displaced by the fighting, including Fazilat and her sister Nilo, both dancers from a musical family. They and many others have returned, but a sense of security has not.
The conditions have improved now. Well, it's better than in the past, but fear still persists. People don't stay outside their homes for long during the night. In the past, people stayed out until 1 or 2 a.m. But now, all the doors are closed at 10 p.m. People still feel insecure.
But it's not only the fear of violence that's remained since the Taliban left. Female dancers such as Fazilat and Nilo have found that the Taliban's war on music left a lasting mark on the Swat Valley's cultural life. If they were once able to make a respectable living as dancers and singers, today their work is widely considered immoral, and they feel ostracized from normal society. Fazilat and Nilo live on Bonner Street, the traditional home of musicians in Mingora. Although Nilo loves music and dance, she says it was desperation that made her turn to this now poorly regarded profession.
People visit our homes. They just enjoy their time and then leave. They don't give us any respect. if we are associated with the arts, if we sing or dance, we do it for people's happiness. But we are not given our proper place in society. The story of my life is this. My father was a taxi driver, but he became sick with hepatitis C. That's why I started singing and dancing. My brothers are young and they can't work. There are many problems in this field, but we have to deal with them.
Some dancers, struggling to make a living, have turned to prostitution, and the stigma associated with them has spread to the whole community. Fazilat says it's common for men who pay to see female dancers to expect them to act as prostitutes, an attitude that was not common before the Taliban.
Nowadays, no one understands the circumstances have forced us to join this profession. They just come, sit, talk, and act however they want. They don't care that their actions can also insult us.
More than 150 musicians' families have returned to Bonner Street. Poverty and the loss of respect are driving some to consider giving up their musical traditions. But with few functioning schools in Swat, the alternatives for children are limited.
Our kids are not getting education because all the schools were bombed and destroyed by the Taliban. Earlier they went to school, but then this crisis happened. All the schools were destroyed. Now where can they get their education?
For now, dancers and musicians are continuing to perform and learn from their elders on Bonner Street. But it will take a long time for Swat's musical culture to recover from the Taliban's crackdown.
That was correspondent Gregory Pfeiffer with a report by Araf Yarel's Radio Mashal. And that's all we have for this week. I'm Bruce Jacobs. Thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.